Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to MitoAction's monthly expert series. Today, Dr. Bedoyan has joined us to discuss pyruvate dehydrogenase complex deficiency essentials, including current trials, research, and prospects for newborn screening. My name is Stephanie Harry. I'm one of the patient support coordinators at MitoAction and will be your host for today. Today's presentation will be recorded and available on MitoAction's website in the coming days, as well as on our podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. We encourage you to ask questions throughout the presentation using the Q&A feature on the bottom menu bar of your screen. We will do our best to get through as many questions as possible at the end of today's presentation. Dr. Bedoyan is an associate professor of pediatrics at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine and the Division of Genetic and Genomic Medicine. He directs the Clinical Biochemical Genetics Fellowship Program and Medical Genetics Clinical Research at UPMC Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh. He's a University of Pittsburgh IRB committee member and serves on the United Mitochondrial Disease Foundation Scientific and Medical Advisory Board. His clinical and research interests include inborn errors of metabolism, including disorders of pyruvate metabolism, particularly pyruvate dehydrogenase complex deficiency and pyruvate carboxylase deficiency. He sees both pediatric and adult patients. Thank you so much, Dr. Bedoyan, for coming here today, sharing your research, your passion, your insight. We're really, really excited to hear all that you've been working on in our community and learn more.
Thank you, Stephanie. Thank you for inviting me, and also thank Kira Mann for arranging this as well. And whoever the committee is that decides on who to invite, I'd like to thank them all. So, can I share my slide then?
Yes, go ahead and
Okay.
share your screen.
Let me see if I can do it and not cause a disaster. Okay. All right. So this is the first slide. So I'm Jerry Bedoyan, and what I'll be talking to you about is some of the essentials about PDC deficiency. So, so PDC deficiency is a pyruvate dehydrogenase complex deficiency, and some of the trials and research we're doing here, but also focus on the newborn screen aspects of things. And some of those newborn screen slides, I need to thank Sue Clemens from Soul Therapeutics for helping put together some of those slides, and I integrated them in my talk here. So conflicts of interest. One of our clinical trials is sponsored by Ultragenyx, and my outline is again focusing on the PDCD essentials. Introduce our active trials and investigations at UPMC. I'll focus on the natural history study and something called FNIRS, that is something that we're piloting. Then jump into newborn screening, some of the overview limitations, and how to add a new disorder, and what is RUSP, and what are some of the data that we have on newborn screening prospects for PDC disorder. And lastly, this is a little more technical, is our approach for protein-specific target-based small molecule therapeutics to restore PDC function, and where we are without disclosing too much new information before I'm ready for doing that. We have it, but I just want to give you a taste of it so that you can come back in 6 months or 1 year and see me again, and then we can talk. So the takeaways. So I have a few slides where I give the takeaways and then go into the slides. So PDC is a mitochondrial neurometabolic disorder of carbohydrate glucose oxidation that mostly affects the brain and leads to decreased ATP production. So among the many inborn errors of metabolism, it's classified under an energy deficit disorder. A PDC is a large multi-enzyme mitochondrial matrix complex. So it's in the mitochondrial matrix, but we know that it also translocates to the nuclear environment. How it does that is still not known, and is involved in histone acetylation and differentiation of genes there too. But its main role is in the mitochondrial matrix. There's more than 38 genes associated with enzymatic PDC deficiency, but I'll be focusing on a few of them later on. About 85% of the cases are due to these two mutations in the X-linked PDHA1 gene, and we've subclassified them into three groups, at least. One is the primary specific PDC group, and one is primary generalized PDC group, and one is secondary PDC. PDCD is a major cause of primary congenital lactic acidosis. It's the second most common genetically resolved mitochondrial disorder in the NAMDAC registry, second only to POLGI and POLGI-related mitochondrial disorders. From our studies, the incidence is at least 1 in 40,000 live births annually in North America. This is from Ohio and Pennsylvania studies. And there's limited therapeutics, and we'll go over some of that. But ketogenic diet is currently still the main untargeted option for these children. Okay, so this is a basic review. We have three kind of food sources that we use to get our energy from: fat, carbohydrate, and proteins. And essentially, all of the metabolism and essentially the carbohydrate or glycolysis part of it happens in the cytosol to get the pyruvate. And then the pyruvate is then transported across the mitochondrial membrane, and within the mitochondrial matrix now is this dehydrogenase, the PDC complex, the pyruvate dehydrogenase complex. And the product of pyruvate reaction with this enzyme is the acetyl-CoA, which is about 12 o'clock of the TCA cycle. And the whole TCA cycle's purpose is to generate reducing potential NADHs and also GTP and NFADH, but mostly NADHs that then get fed into the electron transport chain, and then out goes the ATP and in goes the hydrogen gradient in an oxidative way. There is another dehydrogenase that is structurally and functionally very similar to the PDC. It's called the alpha-ketoglutarate dehydrogenase at 5 o'clock here of the TCA cycle. Just hold on to that thought for a second, because many of these NAD-dependent dehydrogenases are very similar. So one thing we discover from PDC, we can apply for other disorders. So the complex is a multi-enzyme complex. It has the E1 component, E2 component, E3 component. The E3 is shared by the many other dehydrogenases. The E1, E2 are unique to PDC. There is a regulators, PDC, PDH kinase, and phosphatase. And one of the small molecule products that's being reviewed by the FDA, dichloroacetate, works on the kinase here. So it works on the regulator of the PDC complex. And the E1 component is made of two gene products, PDHA1 and PDHB. Thymine is a cofactor. It gets phosphorylated inside the mitochondria to thymine pyrophosphate. It has to bind in the active site, and the first step of the reaction is a decarboxylation reaction. Then the acyl group is transferred to the E2. That transferring happens with this aid of this lipoyl moiety that is an 8-carbon moieties that is important. So, and there's a whole slew of genes that synthesize this 8-carbon moieties and then place them on these E2 components, not only in this dehydrogenase, but other dehydrogenases. This is where the slide comes in. So the other dehydrogenases that have the lipoyl moieties and the E3 component shared is the alpha-ketoglutarate dehydrogenase. That's the 5 o'clock of the TCA cycle, the deoxyadipic acid dehydrogenase. Again, the E2 component is lipoylated, DLD is the third, the E3 component is shared, and the branched chain ketoacid dehydrogenase. That's the most important one, in my opinion, because it any defect in that causes MSUD. And so we have few patients with an alpha-keto dehydrogenase deficiency that I know about, but then much more MSUDs, and the only therapy for that disorder is liver transplant. So how is the biochemical consequences of an enzyme defect? So when you have a defective enzyme, the substrate that is supposed to be converted to product, which is acetyl-CoA, accumulates, and there is a transamination reaction that generates alanine, or a lactate dehydrogenase generates lactate. So the two main consequences of a defective is increase in alanine, increase in lactate. But once lactate reaches a certain level, 5 millimolar or more, 75% of the proline oxidase, which is the first enzyme in the proline metabolism, gets inhibited. And so proline gets also elevated. And what is unique about PDC deficiency as opposed to other primary mitochondrial disorders is that the lactate to pyruvate ratio is normal, 10 to 20. And that's all I have. Well, the other thing that one needs to know is it's important to not dismiss slight elevation of lactate. And when I see patients, in addition to getting lactate, I get a urine organic acid because the cutoff for seeing renal excretion of lactate is 4 millimolar. So anything above 4 millimolar, when you're suspecting whether the draw was a hard draw, the kid was crying or something or not, is if you have a urine organic acid associated with that and you're seeing spilling of lactate in there, that's a confirmation that it's real and that's it's not a fake elevation of lactate. The structure of the E1 component is a dimer of heterodimers. So alpha beta from PDHA1 and PDHB and alpha prime beta prime. And so there's two active sites. The thymine pyrophosphate is these spherical balls within the active site. And then the reaction is what is often called is a flip-flop reaction. So by the time one thymine pyrophosphate is binding and you have the first reaction of the decarboxylation and the S acyl group is being transferred to the E2 component, then the other thymine pyrophosphate in the other component is starting the decarboxylation reaction. And so it goes back and forth. So it's not a static structure, even though you see it static. It's a very movable structure where there are certain interactions that are essential for proper reaction to occur. There is a superstructure. So it's not only the E1 component. So what is at least known, this is the one on the right side is a simulation of the components and the interactions that we're aware of. And it's almost like a donut. So it's where the E1 components are at the edges of the donut. The inside of the donut is where the E2s are, and the E2 arms and the E3s are on the lateral, on the outside of the donut. So that's a huge structure. So there's 30 copies of E1 within the structure, 60 copies of E2, and E3, there's 12 or so structures. And there's, so what's the clinical feature? So it presents very broadly. In a neonatal onset, usually it's a severe, infantile, early childhood, usually moderate. I call usually because they can be severe as well, depending on how they were missed. And late onset in children and adult usually is mild. So clinical features, the main features are hypotonia, developmental delay, and there could be, you know, brain anomalies, ventriculomegaly, corpus callosum abnormalities, seizures, Lee syndrome presentations where deep midline midbrain and basal ganglia is affected, ataxia especially among the milder ones, and exercise induced ataxia, visual impairments, cortical optical nerve hypoplasia or atrophy, nystagmus, strabismus, hearing impairments. Other features include hemiplegia, alternating hemiplegia, Guillain-Barré-like symptoms, episodic paroxysmal exercise-induced dystonia or ataxia, where some of those are actually thymine-responsive, and or other neuropathies and myopathies. Neurocognitive impairments and neurobehavioral abnormalities are common and variable, so like autism or the ADHD and things like that. But 4% of patients with PDC deficiency due to PDHA1 interestingly have normal brain imaging by CT or MRI. This was a finding from Peter Stackpool's group many years ago. Females have better survival, but surviving females are more severely affected. And the median and mean ages of diagnosis are about 12 months and 31 months, respectively. So we need to do something about that. And that's what the newborn screen prospect and the push for that is coming from. So the therapeutic approaches. So we can either provide the missing product, the acetyl-CoA, and that's where the untargeted ketogenic diet, which is the mainstay, comes about, because you're generating ketone bodies cross the blood-brain barrier, and then they're converted to acetyl-CoA, and then they feed into the TCA cycle. Our approach is to restore the defective component of the complex, and we're focusing on the PDHA1 or the E1 alpha component, and I'll talk about that later. or you replace the defective component altogether, either by gene editing. So there's gene therapy approaches. At least I'm aware of two places that are doing that, maybe three, no, three, one in Europe and two in the United States. The enzyme replacement therapy that's used for mucopolar sarcoidosis doesn't really work because the big enzymes are not able to cross the blood-brain barrier, and there's going to be an issue targeting it into the mitochondrial matrix. While these two issues can be addressed with this approach of restoring the defect. Then you have these regulators of the PDC, DCA is one of them. So it inhibits the PDH kinase. And so what it's doing is if there is some mutant activity, you're trying to maximize that mutant activity. And usually DCA is going to maximize things by between 10 and 20% in terms of activity. So it all depends on what the threshold and where the activity is and what the gender of the patient is, to what extent PDH is going to be, DCA is going to impact. And for the most part, it has a good impact on reducing the lactic acidosis and also some of the motor components of this defect. It's been also used in PDH phosphatase, and we've published on them too. Or provide the cofactor, which is thymine, and this is focused on those that are thymine responsive cases. So I've put together some of the list of from the literature that's known, that's shown to be thymine responsive. And one thing that I would like to sort of discuss or caution you is even though they're thymine responsive, the normal RDA for a human being to have thymine is about 1 millimole, 1 milligram. So you can see this is the wild type curve of PDC E1 activity. And these two variants are the red one and the green one are thymine responsive to different extents. So you know you're increasing the normal thymine by tenfold or hundredfold or thousandfold to get good potency, to get the curve to reflect what is wild type. But note that it's not reaching maximal efficacy, and so that still means to me that, and I see this in patients, is that even with thymine responsiveness, depending on what the mutation is, you may still need to provide some strength of ketogenic diet to give them a little more oomph or boost to their energy needs in real life. So we are putting together, or we've put together a PDC guidelines team, myself and Dr. Shamima Rahman from, you know, from England, with 15 investigators, some of them, 8 of them from Europe, 7 from United States, 2 early career representatives, 4 dietitians, 2 from US, 2 from Europe, and with the involvement of the PDC family groups, to kind of come through in an evidence-based way, a consensus guidelines for PDC deficiency, and which has never been done before. So we had our first meeting back in October 14th, and we'll have that on a monthly basis. And we'll finish off with one in-person meeting either in the United States or UK. And the support is coming from the SSIEM. This is the International Inherited Errors of Metabolism Society, and philanthropy support that I have from one of these groups, the Elizabeth Watt PDC Research Fund. And this project will be eventually reported in JIMD, the Journal of Inherited Metabolic Disease. So what are the current active PDC investigations at UPMC here? So we have the natural history study so far, and that study has started back in 2014 through 2 cycles of NIH funding. And so we have about over 115 subjects enrolled in it. It's NIH supported, it's on clinical trials, and there is a virtual component to enrolling these patients or an in-person component. So any patient within the United States or Canada can be enrolled in this study. And we can access their medical information and go on from there. The C7 or triheptanoin, this is the Jolvi product that's used in fatty acid oxidation. We're trying to see how it fares with patients with PDCs deficiency, specifically with primary specific PDC deficient patients. Those are the specific gene product components that constitute the actual component of the complex. So I'm talking about PDHA1, PDHB, DLAT, PDHX, PDP1. So those are the main components. So our goal is it's a pilot study with enrolling 6 affected individuals. We have enrolled 2 so far. Trial of DCA in PDC. That's a phase 3 study. It's active but not recruiting. This is the study where the FDA reviewing the efficacy information and the study, and there is a great hope in this product being the first product for PDC deficiency. FNIRS, and I'll talk a little more about this. We're planning to enroll 9 affected and 6 age matched controls. And then we continue to use advanced genetics for disorders of pyruvate metabolism, whole exome and whole genome sequencing. There is the newborn screening project, and then there is the protein specific. So I'll touch upon these red ones and go on a little bit about the small molecule one. So the natural history one, it's a questionnaire of 68 questions. In addition to getting medical information, we have a questionnaire that individuals and families actually fill. And about 60% of the questions have to do with the disease. About 12% of the questions is demographics. About a quarter of the questions has to do with the diet and the medications. And there's some questions about the family history and both affected and asymptomatic females that are carriers are also enrolled in these studies. So functional near-infrared spectroscopy. So the functional part means that there is something that the patient is doing, just like there is functional MRI. And near-infrared spectroscopy means that there is a light source that is used to create the spectrum, and we're collecting information. And this is something new, and I thought that it would be a good idea to try it on PDC patients, and if it works well, it could be also potentially used and expanded to other mitochondrial disorders of neurocognitive dysfunction, because one idea is to maybe able to use this as an outcome measure for looking at what the brain hemodynamics and neural activation of the brain functional connectivity is pre-therapeutics and post-therapeutics. So, and follow these patients over time. Well, but this is a pilot work, and they've done work on using on patients with ornithine transcarbamylase deficiency. That's a urea cycle, one of the more common urea cycle disorders. They've done this on glucose transporter type 1 deficiency and MSUD. And this is, when I say they, this is Andrea Gropman's group with Dr. Kosar Haksari, and I'm collaborating with them. And Andrea and Dr. And Kosar have moved from the Children's National down to St. Jude's, and we're continuing our collaboration. So far, we have about 5 individuals enrolled, but we're going to enroll another 6 to 10 additional individuals. So what are the tasks that they get involved with, in addition to wearing this this cap with the light sources? And not all the PDC patients are going to be able to do this. And that's why we have sort of a range of individuals from mild to moderate to more severe ones enrolled in these studies, in this study. The Stroop test measures the executive processing ability. The NBAC, so it, for example, are you able to tell that green as a word is not, there's incongruence to that, and the red is and the color is green, there is an incongruence, that sort of an executive processing ability of a kid greater than 5 years of age. The NBAC is how do you recognize repeating letters or words. And that, but most of the kids will be able to just look at the video if they're not visually impaired, and look at a video that has motion on it, or a video with the motion and a language in it. This way, we can map the difference parts of the brain and look at what. This is an example of a patient. This is a patient with the cap on with the light source watching the video. Mom is holding her, and then this is our team, and this is an age-matched control and watching the same thing. And we can get a readout actually of what the brain neural activation centers are depending on how many light sources are in the brain. And this is the study that has been published for controls and OTC deficient patients from the urea cycle study from Andrea's group that was published back about 4 years ago. And this is a prefrontal cortex changes that is noted in these patients. Switching to newborn screening. So was first developed, and everyone knows about this, babies within the first 24, 48 hours get their heels poked, and then these blood spots are collected on a papers, and then these spots are then sent to a newborn screening lab to analyze them for different analytes. It was first developed back in 1963 by Robert Guthrie for population-based testing of newborns for PKU. Over the last 40 years, its use, and so the original Wilson and Junger criteria was established. It's a screening program which should respond to recognized need. The objectives of the screening program should be defined at the outset. There should be a defined targeted population. There should be a scientific evidence of the screening program's effectiveness. The program should integrate education, testing, and clinical services and program management, and where the patients that were picked up are going to follow. There should be quality assurance with mechanisms to minimize potential risks of screening. The program should promote equity and access to screening for the entire targeted population, not the select group. And the program evaluation should be planned from the outset, and the overall benefit of the screening should outweigh the harm. And it's been effectively used in the United States and now elsewhere and globally. And these are some of the frequency or the incidence of some of the IEMs currently known. And for example, in a population of 130,000 live births in Ohio, annually, we would expect about nine newborns to have MCAD annually. And so what is given that at least the incidence of PDC deficiency is about 1 in 40,000, in a place like Ohio, we should expect to see about 3 of them annually. And the same goes with Pennsylvania, that has the similar live annual birth frequencies. It's still a screening test. Screen positive or red flag merit rapid follow-up and diagnostic confirmation for the testing, either by chemical, enzymatic, and or molecular. And it does not catch every affected newborns, and not every newborn is screened. And so there is a turnaround time to this. It's prone to false negatives. So that's the sensitivity question. There's some folks with objections to move ahead with newborn screening. And there is incongruity sometimes if you're in these newborn screen committee meetings, and then you see there's incongruencies between the birth certificates and the actual dried blood spots, incomplete information that is there out there that the lab folks have to go back and complete if they can. There's a threshold cutoff set to catch as many as possible, so. So that's prone to false positives. So the specificity question is important: where to draw the cutoff, how to set that is debatable and can change over time. Not all of the disorders are represented on newborn screening. Older children, adults, individuals born in other countries may or may not have had the newborn screening. So selection of disorders for newborn screening, disease characteristics for newborn screen consideration. What's the disease incidence? So that's why we had done this semi-prospective study and the follow-up retrospective studies to kind of establish what the incidence of PDCD is, at least in North America. Clinical manifestation of disease, we have a lot about that. Outcome of disease if not treated. Some of these patients that are easily and quickly now placed on ketogenic diets survive for a longer time than early in the 1990s or back when the death rate was within a week, because they were not able to identify them or confirm their diagnosis. And starting a ketogenic diet after that is kind of can be tricky. About feasibility of newborn screening, are we going to put together a whole new analytic approach, or can we use some of the existing analytic approaches and so make it cost efficient and still use the same sort of turnaround times that we are used to? And the question to that is, yes, we have now a method, I think, that it can be easily used with existing technologies. You know, questions about treatment, are there available treatment? How efficacious is this treatment? And so in 2006, ACMG sort of outlined a process of standardizing of the newborn screening process, you know, recommended uniform panel. There's a primary core disorders that newborn screening should include for clear clinical consequences. And then secondary disorders that are screened as a byproduct because of the analyte being able to be picked up, screening the primary may have clinical consequences as well. And the recommended uniform screening panel from the Department of Health and Human Services maintains all the primary and secondary disorders. And this is the website that you can go to. So how is this done? You know, so there is you fill in information about there should be a nominator in there and who fills in the information about what this disorder is, and is what, you know, the questions that need to be answered. Is there a newborn screening test available? Is there an agreement about the case? Definition of the targeted condition, diagnostic confirmation after positive newborn screening. Is there a prospective population-based newborn screening project that has identified at least one infant with this condition? Can identification of the targeted condition before clinical presentation allow provision of effective therapy and improved outcomes for screened infants? So there is the committee nomination and prioritization work group that sort of reviews all this preliminary nomination form and verifies that the nomination meets the four basic requirements. They work with the other committee, the committee that eventually votes for it, to then set up, send this information to this evidence-based review group that sort of goes back and looks at the evidence and provides updates and presents a final report to the committee on assigned condition. So, and then eventually the committee deliberates and votes on it from the evidence that is presented by the ERG. They use a decision matrix and accompanying decision matrix guidance to guide their final decisions. Then the committee votes to recommend or not recommend adding dominated condition to the RUSP for consideration by the Secretary of Health and Human Services. And the secretary then has the final decision on it, whether to add or not to add it on the RUSP. And so just because a disease is approved by RUSP doesn't mean it's going to be automatically placed on the state newborn screen panel. But even if a disease is not approved by RUSP, it can still be placed on state newborn screen panels, and it's very much dependent on state and to state. So what do we have in terms of biomarkers that we can use for PDC? And that's the takeaway here. And then I'll go into more detail. So PDC, at least we know, is 1 in 40,000 live births annually in the United States. Whether that's the case in Europe or Asia is not. So that means that, you know, in the state of Ohio or Pennsylvania, you'll have at least 3 live births with PDC annually. In the whole United States, that means we're talking about 95 to 100 babies annually will have PDC worldwide. If this is also reflected worldwide, this incidence, it means that we're having about 3,300 to 3,500 babies worldwide annually with this disorder. So Many newborn screen labs before this study, actually, the study back in 2018 to 2019, and I worked with the newborn screen lab in Ohio to add alanine and proline as analytes that is quantitated in the lab. And so that was the one big first thing to do. And the next thing to do is from the data that we published, it became obvious that alanine itself as a single absolute value is not as sensitive as if you start looking at the ratios of alanine to leucine, alanine to lysine, and different combinations. Why leucine and lysine? These are the only two amino acids that are purely ketogenic amino acids. So they're not used, PDC is not used to generate acetyl-CoA from metabolism of leucine and lysine. It go directly is makes the acetyl-CoA and then uses up in the TCA cycle. So we figured this would be a good normalizing amino acid and looking at whether the sensitivities are improved or not. And actually, depending on which ratio you use and which combination ratio you use, they're highly sensitive biomarkers, but they're not specific. As we can see in the data, you're going to pick up many mitochondrial disorders, many organic acidemias, like fatty acid oxidation disorders and MMA with this. So the specificity is going to come from adding a second-tier molecular testing on the panel so that one can either sequence PDH1 alone if these ratios flag from the first analysis, and you will be picking up about 85% of all the cases, or if you add five primary specific genes for which ketogenic diet is the right mainstay diet right now, PDHA1, PDHB, DLAT, PDHB1, and PDHX, then you're picking up about 90% of PDHA, PDCD cases. So this was the first newborn screen study. So we, the Ohio Newborn Screen Lab was able to generate this and have alanine and proline as analytes back in 2016. And then they were able to provide, and then it was came into effect in May 2018. It took about 2 years for the committee to approve and for it to be tested and all that. And then what we asked from them is to give us 1 year of data of all newborn screens, and they were de-identified, except that we wanted gestational age, birth weight, whether they were placed on, had any blood products, where they were in the NICU or not, and that kind of information. But who they were and what their disorder was not clear. And so we looked at the 99.9 percentile for alanine to leucine and proline to leucine ratios. Those are 217 red dots. And if we add the cutoffs of alanine to leucine and proline to leucine, we come down to 146 dots that we need to find out who they are. And why is that important and practical? Because 145 in a year means about 12 in a month, which means about three or four flagging in a week for a newborn screen lab, which is very doable. And so, and what we had done is we then sent off flyers to the major medical centers in the state of Ohio, telling us who they have diagnosed in that year's period after May 4th, 2018, with a confirmed diagnosis of either pyruvate dehydrogenase complex deficient, disorder of mitochondrial disorders, or disorders of pyruvate metabolism, other disorder, organic acidemias, fatty acid oxidation disorders. So that's where we picked up these three individuals with PDHA1 and two individuals with a mitochondrial disorder. So we published on that. So when I moved from Cleveland to Pittsburgh, I wanted to expand on this. So I said, okay, it's some newborn screen labs are easier to work with than the others. So I got a little bump here. So I said, okay, let's work backwards, retrospectively look at 11 years of data from UPMC and look at first amino acids on confirmed diagnoses of patients and what they look like for these various ratios and all that. And so these are box whisker plots. So anything above this box here is the upper quartile. Anything below is the lower quartile. The straight line is the median, and the X is the mean. So you can see these different conditions: MELAS, MRF, propionic acidemia, MMA, Lee syndrome, fatty acid oxidation, non-IAMs as controls, Barr syndrome, all of them we looked at. And we looked at these 3, 5, 6, 7 ratios and did an analysis. I'm forgetting the name. To look at these ratios and which one has the higher likelihood of being effective there. And so the red ones imply that this combination of alanine to leucine, alanine lysine is quite effective, or this ratio with this one is quite effective. The green ones are poor ratios for PDC deficiency. And actually, citrulline is one that we use because citrulline is a good marker for certain other mitochondrial disorders like ATP6 deficiency and MELAS. We use principal component analysis to look at how the spread of the PDC patients are from MELAS. There's some good spread from the MELASes. There's a little bit of an overlap with fatty acid oxidation. It's not surprising. A little bit of overlap with another organic acidemia, PA, and MMA, and good separation from the non-IEM. So we are building on what we found by collaborating with Austin Larson over at Colorado Children's Hospital, where we shared our protocol, and they actually have the aniline and proline as analyzed that they measure in Colorado. I'm also working with Patricia Hall. She's the lab director of the Mayo Clinic. They use the CLEAR process where they have 5 million reference samples and 20,000 diagnosed cases to look at what these analyzed and the ratios will be. Eventually, they'll be working on resolving the lysine from glutamine by applying a rather novel LC-MSMS method that being tested in Connecticut, and the CDC knows about this. And it may be applied in other newborn screen labs with very little change and very little cost added, but you would be able to resolve lysine quite well from glutamine. And our lab director, Steve Dabrowski, we have a sort of a prospective study where any patient above a certain cutoff is flagged and the amino acid is sent to us, to me, and then I look at the ratios and follow this patient. And then I've presented at the APHL newborn screen webinar, and so there's some interest in moving ahead and considering PDC as a prospect for newborn screening. And so this is actually unpublished data that we're working on to publish from a collaboration with Ohio. So these 6 patients are actually were picked up by the newborn screen. And the other 14 patients, other mitochondrial, and how they fare from newborn screen data versus first plasma amino acid data. And so you can see where the median and the mean is, and how the PDHs fall in their own little quadrants here. But with them is LIPT1. LIPT1 is that primary generalized PDC deficiency where it helps generate the lipoate group on the E2 component in other hardcore primary mitochondrial disorders. So mitochondrial disorders is going to be picked up. That's why the secondary screen, the second tier testing with a molecular test of either PDHA1 alone or the 5 genes of primary specific genes would be the way to go. And I use these ratios to see how well the patients are metabolically stable pre-ketogenic diet and post-ketogenic diet. They fall into this little quadrant here. You can see this principal component analysis, how they sort of clump together when they're metabolically stable and doing well on a ketogenic diet. This is the CLEAR data where we're losing and comparing it with the 2 million or 5 million, sorry, reference samples and where these specific ratios fall. And there's a little bit of overlap with the references we're working on, and there's other markers that that are coming out from these ratios that we need to expand on, but this is a work in progress. Other specific markers really sort out and separate out, let's say, mitochondrial ATP6 from the references, but there is no treatment for this disorder. So ratios are and involvement with CLEAR was an important step. So quickly in the next 5 minutes, so what's the basis behind using small molecules? So I was interested in looking at only disease-causing missense variants of PDHA1, and that constitute about 55-60% of all the PDHA1 mutations. The other 40% are due to, you know, premature stops, you know, deletions, etc. So, and we wanted to see where do those missense mutations fall, and 86% of those are deep buried inside the E1 structure. So this was done by solvent accessibility surface area analysis, and among those buried components, about a third of them, by comparing how buried they are in the E1 alone or E1 alpha alone or the E1 with the dimer of dimers, the structure, one can say that about a third of them are involved in subunit interface contact. So helps keep those subunits all together in a proper way. And so, and we mapped where these amino acids are. And you can see that they're not randomly all over the place. They're in specific places that are important for nearest neighbor contact and subunit interaction. And the one that we focused on is this R349, where in genetic reports, it's called PDHA1P378C, or there's only two variants of that, either cysteine replacement or histidine. So this is what the structure is like. Arginine is the normal amino acid. It's replaced with cysteine, the green, or the histidine. And so it normally makes this electrostatic or salt bridge interaction with the glutamine 281 from the beta. And we figured if this is missing, then there is a pocket in the structure here. But what in reality it happens is those interactions that this arginine is making with not only this glutamine, but other amino acids close by is what holds that part of the structure together. And when it's not there, the subunits are unstable. And but it forms a pocket. And so we know that this communication network between the structures by MD simulation is in areas that are known to cause where the amino acid replacements cause disease. So we've mapped them at least by SASA and nearest neighbor analysis to this eigenvector centrality analysis to these regions on the alpha, alpha prime, beta, and beta prime subunit. So the project is then to look at pharmacological chaperonins, so these small molecules that will go in a kinetic way, bind in that spot just enough to hold things together to improve some activity. And that activity can be looked at either by seeing restoration of protein stability or subunit stability, looking at cellular and mitochondrial bioenergetic changes, or looking at PDC activity enhancement when these cells are grown in glucose-only media. So the first part of this is completed. We've done virtual screening with machine learning and deep learning. And so of 200,000 small compounds. And as AI is going to be more into the sciences, you can imagine that the AI can generate many more structures, random structures that can be chemically synthesized and test these in a massive way on different pockets that we're interested in for different mutations. So we've done molecular dynamic simulations on these molecules, and we've identified some lead compounds. And so we've tested those lead compounds for permeability. So our two important criteria is, can these compounds cross the blood-brain barrier, number one. Number two, can we tag these ligands to target them into the mitochondrial matrix and for these ligands or the tags to be released from the mitochondrial matrix so that that ligand now goes and does what it's supposed to do. And then the phase three, and I'm only mentioning it because we have good results from this stage, so we're starting to think about how to think of preclinical work using mouse models for the next steps and to test the safety, tolerability, efficacy, and pharmacokinetics. So we have at least four ligands. Two of them are tagged so far. All of them are being tested. So three or four are tested for permeability, and this is the tag. It's a peptide tag with a prodrug, and the first part of the cleavage happens endogenously by endogenous enzymes within the mitochondrial matrix, and then the removal of the prodrug happens chemically to release the drug that acts as a ligand. I have a lot of folks to thank, most importantly, Doug Kerr, who gave me the passion. He was my mentor, my colleague, and a friend. He's retired now, but he gave me the passion to follow patients with PDC deficiency. Jerry Vockley, for inviting me and bringing me to Pittsburgh, and for his lab group to be interested and engaged in this research. Caitlin Bloom is doing a lot of the in vitro experiments. The team from the organic chemists and medicinal chemists are Peter Wipf and Matt Laporte that do the tagging. And then Oles Isayev, Hadi Gokhan, and Polina are at the Computational Chemistry Mellon Institute at Carnegie Mellon. They do a lot of the computer computational chemistry, and they're the ones that, as a team, we found these compounds that we need to test further. And there's a lot of people to thank, many of the medical students who and residents and fellows who became attendings now. And then the grants that are supported by is the NIH grant, for the RDCRN, UMDF NAMDAC grant, some of the Gateway for Mitochondrial Medicine for some of the medical students and the fellows, and the pilot grant. I'm thankful for the Ultragenyx. I'm thankful for, and most importantly, the Elizabeth Watt PDC Research Fund that provided generously 2 years in a row so that we can do these small molecule research. And I'm very thankful that we're able to use that fund for that research. Any questions now? Okay, there's a chat. There's a lot of questions.
Yes, there's lots of questions. So I'm going to kind of go through it. I might try to combine some for time. But if you want to go ahead and unshare your screen, Dr. Bedoyan, this was absolutely amazing. And I think you also showed the importance of there's lots of different things going on at one time. Like you're discovering things about how the proteins are working and functioning together. And that's so important, especially as you're looking into small molecule treatments and being able to have that information. And so and then the newborn screening is important because as you have treatments available, it's important that it's on the newborn screening. So you'll see, notice that there's lots of questions about all of your area of your talk. So thank you so much for breaking everything down for us. I want to maybe start with, well, I'm going to start with the clinician's question first, and then maybe we can go into newborn screening. The first question is, if we measure elevated lactate levels and acidic pH levels, would it be possible to give sodium bicarbonate to normalize the pH level value of a patient with PDCD?
Well, bicarb is used in managing these patients, and mostly it's you're not going to use it to correct the lactate. Your lactate is going to be corrected to some extent with DCA and also a ketogenic diet, but the ketogenic diet is going to generate its own acid, the organic acid, the ketones. Ketone bodies are all acidic, so that's where the bicarb is going to come in to sort of correct that gap that you're generating from now the elevated ketones. You see what I'm saying? So you're replacing one gap. So just think of lactate as another organic acid. Do you see what I'm saying? And so you're replacing that gap that's from the lactic acid with the gaps that's being generated by the ketones. And so the idea is can we replace some of that gap, the acidic gap, by using some other untargeted substrate? So that's why, looking at C7 and its benefit is coming in to see, can we still maintain good clinical balance with alanine and lactate, but then giving a breather in terms of the amount of ketone bodies that's being generated from the diet. And so
So in regards to newborn screening, is the nomination process when you're nominating a new condition for newborn screening, is it something that you have to do individually per your state, or is it something that you can do on a national level by your team or another organization? How does that typically work?
The details, I don't know because I've never done it. We're going to do it. But okay. I think it's a nomination process that I think it... either a group or, once you have these discussions with the committees on RUSP or the committees that are part of that selection committee, and they know what you're doing, they know what the therapies are, there will be a consensus that this is going to be a good thing to nominate, then you move ahead. You know what I'm saying? It's almost like, you don't jump into something that you don't have good preliminary data and good consensus among the different groups, and then you build on it. Once you do it, then you make the strongest case you have once the nomination has started. And like there is a review committee, a committee that reviews what evidence is it. So once we have a PDC guidelines, once we have a few reviews out there, once we have a few other papers out there and the collaborations, folks will be able to say, yeah, there is strong evidence. Let's move ahead with this. Do you see what I'm saying? So there's a lot of groundwork to do, because unless maybe you have a big sponsor whose okay. child, whose relative is affected by this, and is going to pour in millions of billions of dollars to do this and push this. That's not the reality most of the time. So you're going to build it up. That's my opinion. I mean, that's another reason why I got interested in small molecules is actually that's how the therapy for cystic fibrosis has started, with a small molecule of a very select genotype of patients with CF. And that were treated with avacaftor. And then they moved on with the three small molecules in one vial that now covers about 85% of all the patients with cystic fibrosis, only small molecules. And so what it does is it's changing the transmembrane domain by binding to it and allowing this calcium to go in through the channel. And so that had huge quality of life effect. So gene editing, gene therapy is what's now being pushed, and it's exciting, but you can imagine paying $1 to $2 million, $3 million for one gene therapy on a very select targeted group of patients that are going to be benefiting in a country like United States, where at the most you're going to have 90 to 100. But then what about the other world, where population is mostly going to be in Asia, in India, in Africa? How are they going to benefit from this very expensive therapy? So a small molecule is going to have its place for a select group of mutations. And building up on that is what I hope. And again, like I said, there's no known therapy for MSUD. And if this works well with this dehydrogenase, everybody is going to jump on using it for MSUD, because there's nothing.
And that's exciting. So there,
it's
so,
very
and
exciting.
That's part of, so stay tuned, everyone. That's part of the excitement and future conversations that are going to be had. So read between the lines, I guess, too, of the excitement that exists there, and hold on hope, because I think a lot of times for our community, being able to have the hope that treatments are in the pipeline, because it's hard to see all that's going on behind the scenes. Like even all that you shared in regards to the newborn screening, I mean, that's a lot of groundwork that you set just to get to the place to introduce and suggest that it be added to the newborn screening. How much time did that take you, all of that you put
it
together?
It took me a year and a half to convince the committee in Ohio to add alanine and proline. A year and a half. And then another year of data collection and another year of analysis. So just to get that one paper out was a big feat, and there were doubters, right? I mean, that this is going, you know, so you're going to hit the bumps and you're going to pass through these bumps. And there were doubters on this small molecule story. I mean, you can see the rejections I got in my NIH submissions. You know, this is not going to work. This is not doable. This is, you know, and we had to prove the naysayers. And it's a hard work. And I thank those who are engaged in these research. I thank the philanthropy fund providers, supporters, that they are supporting the idea. And I'm excited that folks from Carnegie Mellon and folks from organic chemistry listened. You know, they were saying, okay, Jerry, let's do this together. I mean, adding a tag to a ligand is not a small feat. You know, going through this computational chemistry phase is not a small feat. It took 2 years to get to 4 compounds.
So for those who are really excited about moving forward with the newborn screening part of this and want to help advocate, there's a question that came in as to whether or not there are any recommendations in terms of messaging, or is there a place that patient advocates can go in regards to when they're talking to people who are involved with newborn screening, like the Newborn Screening Advisory Review Committee, like as they're talking with them, how do they go about navigating that? Or is there certain messaging that, and I don't know what the rules are, like what you're allowed to say here, or if there's spaces that you want me to point people to later on?
Yeah, there are these, you know, passing that message to each of the newborn screen lab committees, each of them have their committees, and having a space to present what PDCD is. You know, I've done this at least twice now, one in Ohio, one in Pennsylvania. And some are more receptive than others. Some are limited by the mission of that and not have it as a research part. You know, some newborn screen committees are more open to research. Each state is different. So this is the beauty of our country, is each state and each committee is different. But then ultimately, there is the RUSP that you have to also convince, and they have guidelines that they're going to follow. And so to build, to get to that point, you have to do the research to get there. But things can be bypassed. Like I showed the slide, not everything that's on RUSP is on the newborn screen, you know, in a state. Some states take the chance. New York is very good at that, you know. And I just need some folks to jump in and push it.
I think that's an important point, because as we're looking at this and other conditions, to know that, that certain states tend to pave the way when it comes
they
to this,
pave the
and
way,
it's
and
a
they're
trickle
the leader.
Down.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
California, New York, and Wisconsin, and some of them are leaders in this, and some other states just follow. You know, just like our regular population, they're leaders, they're followers.
So I know we're over one, but we have some really important clinical questions.
Yeah.
If you have time, I'd love to be
yeah.
able to continue
yeah.
to tackle
Go ahead.
Some of them.
I have a few more time.
Okay. So first of all, there was a question in regards to your natural history study and if you're still recruiting. And then you also mentioned there was another study I know that you are recruiting for right now.
We're still recruiting.
The C7. I'm not
yep.
sure what age range that is.
Anybody less than 18 for the C7. But
okay.
But it has to be that the person has to be on a ketogenic diet to be considered, and have one of those 5 genes. And the natural history, we are, and we need more, because, you know, we want to make 20 new enrollees in a year, because unfortunately during the pandemic we were not able to enroll as many, and so our funding from the NIH and our NAMDAC and our DCERN got cut, because we didn't make our goal of 140, 150, even though 120 is the largest new natural history out there for PDC, they still are cutting back our fund, releasing our funds that they've agreed on until we reach our mark of 140. So we need another 15 to 20 individuals to enroll in our natural history study. So I would be delighted if this forum is going to make that happen. So, Danielle,
And they
did
can
I?
go to clinicaltrials.gov,
Yes,
right,
they
to
can go
enroll.
there. The research coordinator is a wonderful person is Danielle Black. She can be reached, and Danielle can work with me and reach out to the families. And like I said, enrollment can be happening virtually on this one, but then we will collect medical information through either Epic eShare or from actually collecting the raw data from the primary metabolic doc. So Danielle Black is the person to go to, and her information is in that clinicaltrials.gov. And oh,
And I just see, yeah, she just put it in
Danielle, she
the,
put in her email. So thank you, Danielle.
I'm gonna, so yes, I will pass that along. And if it's okay, I'm just gonna say it's Danielle, Danielle dot Black at chp.edu. And I'm gonna put it in the main chat too for everyone. In case there's anyone that wants it, but also in case you're listening to this recording and you're like, oh no, I don't have access to the chat. So
And
there's
she's the coordinator for all the clinical trials that we have here. So
okay, that's really
the
helpful.
FNIRS, the C7, she's the person, she's the go-to person. So she's wonderful, and I have weekly meetings with her to catch up with everything. So I really appreciate her help
So
and her passion for this.
There have been some questions that have come through in regards to how wide the spectrum severity is of this disease, and like are many people are most people picked up when they're younger? But I know you showed in the beginning that there was like a spectrum. You can be picked up when you're younger versus older.
Yes.
So I'm wondering if you can break that down a little bit. And then there was a specific question that came in regards to if there's a list of genetic defects that are known not to be thymine responsive.
Well, I know of those that are thymine responsive, and so I work backwards because I assume many of those are not, especially the ones that are affecting the binding site, if there is a big mutation there, if the active site is missing, or if it's a frame shift or a deletion or something, likely it's not going to work. But but if it's a female, then you have some functional component of the other allele, so you can try to maximize and the cofactors so that you're not limited. You can think of again maximizing the activity with DCA. These are the things that, in my opinion, PDCD is still going to be a multi-farm, multi-therapeutic approach. So there's going to be a little bit of a ketogenic diet, a little bit of thymine, a little bit of DCA, and there could be thymine-responsive cases. And the spectrum is quite broad. You can have children that are very mild. They would walk around. They would have some autism or ADHD or fall into this category where they exercise a lot. They can become ataxic, like a walking like a drunk person, or just fall on the ground and feel like they're completely tired, or their toes or their hands contract when they're tired, or they exercise and then relax after that is gone. So that's the one spectrum. And the other one would be a child that is visually impaired, that is nonverbal, that is on a wheelchair, that is G-tube fed, and that has limited interaction. So it's a big spectrum, and so it behooves us to pick up every child, especially the mild and moderate ones, so that those interventions will be much more effective. But then we cannot leave behind the severe ones because it means a lot to the family. And it means improvement of some quality of life and survival, and so it's very important. I mean, I know one patient that we got on this newborn screen study from the very beginning, and she remains involved in all the studies. I've known her for 5 years, very severely affected, but I would bet anything that if we didn't start the ketogenic diet within the first month of life, this child wouldn't be with us. And so quick turnaround in what the disorder is, whether you use whole exome, whole genome, and there you have to be careful because there are some deep intronic mutations, promoter mutations that may or not be read as variants by the clinical lab. So you have to do much more research study in a timely way to pick up these individuals to start the ketogenic diet, or to know which diet or which mix of therapies you want to do, and to stabilize this kid as much as possible. You know, these are nuances of the therapies, and so each patient is in a way unique. You know,
that's helpful, and I think I like how you put value in the spectrum, but then also breaking down, I think, for some of us who are a little less familiar with PDC, just in regards to being able to get a diagnosis. If you are older, so maybe your symptoms were milder, like, and if do the patients typically come with biochemical labs that help support it, even if they can't find the genetic component for it, or how does that?
It's a combination of both. I mean, the child may be 12-month-old and still not crawling, you know, developmentally delayed. There is some tone issues, you know, not able to hold the head up still, you know, for whatever reason, it got missed by the other primary care physicians on this. And then it was shifted to, you know, different services, whether endocrinology or neurology, and eventually end up to genetics. And then you know, so there's and this has been looked at by Soul Therapeutics and others, where there's multiple subspecialties get involved until a final diagnosis is met. And like I said, the median age is 12 months and the mean is 30. Why can't we push this to a week, so that, you know, with the newborn screening, so that we can know how to manage this kid up at the beginning, you know? And it's been shown that you can start ketogenic diet as early as, you know, the first week of life, you know? So why not push the boundaries?
Can you talk a little bit about how the keto diet works as an effective treatment?
So it's a high fat, low carb, and RDA protein diet, right? And so since the defect is in carbohydrate metabolism, you're pushing to have more fat in the diet, so that the fat will generate ketone bodies by normal metabolism. And those ketone bodies, so beta hydroxybutyrate or acetoacetate, they can cross the blood-brain barrier and then they can then get converted back to acetyl-CoA. And that's how you complete that TCA cycle, where you need those reducing potential that comes from NADH to feed into the electron transport chain to get them in. So your neurons, as opposed to astrocytes, the astrocytes have glycogen. Your neurons, their whole source of energy is glucose. You see what I'm saying? And so if glucose is not going to be able to be metabolized, what else are you going to give them to kind of get the acetyl-CoA going through there, you know? And so that's how I think of it. I mean, it used to be called, back in the at the time when this was discovered, again, Dr. Kerr and other folks that were on that study, you know, they called it a high fat diet. That was what it was called initially, and then now it's called a ketogenic diet. And there's various strengths of it, you know, from modified Atkins diet to a high strength ketogenic diet.
So another patient asked, are there known cases of symptomless, undiagnosed male carriers who pass on PDCD to their children who are more affected?
That's a very good question. I'd like to come across some of those. asymptomatic males that pass on their gene to their children that become symptomatic. What is causing them to be asymptomatic, since they have constitutionally the one gene and the same mutation? what is up with that? So I'm curious, whoever that is, you know, and they can reach out to me, and they can be in the natural history study actually, and then I can look into their records and then see what we have.
It sounds like a good plan. It sounds like a good plan. So
I've
just
seen the
know.
reverse, right? You always see that in the females, where a female is so-called asymptomatic, but it's, if you ask more questions, they have migraines. They may be averse to sugar. They get tired easily in the afternoons or during the day. And so they're almost like those so-called asymptomatic OTC deficient female carriers, because OTC gene is also X-linked. So those X-linked genes in females, they have such a variable presentation. It's a spectrum. So a mom that has the mutation can live well, deliver a baby, but her daughter is severely affected. Do you see what I'm saying? That you can have that combination because of this skewed X inactivation that happens in females. One X is inactivated, right? And which X is supposed to inactivate? If it doesn't inactivate properly, and it's then in different tissues, then you have an affected baby.
Well, Dr. Bedoyan, we really, really appreciate you taking the time. There are a couple questions that came through that I thought you might specifically want to connect with someone. So I'll make sure that I'll connect you with those people. And
yeah, connect me. I'm sorry I wasn't able to get to everybody's question. And but I do have another meeting. Actually, it started at 1, but I'll
well,
be
thank
late.
you so much for taking this extra
Yeah,
time. We really appreciate
sorry.
you and all of your wisdom and knowledge. And I hope to bring you back in soon with the other exciting news.
Thank you very much for this opportunity, Stephanie. I appreciate you and Kira very much.
Have a wonderful day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.